So it's a privilege to be able to share with you today from this incredible story that you've been looking at in the life of Solomon. And we come to a challenging couple of chapters because we see some pretty ominous signs starting to appear in Solomon's life. And I want to highlight them because I think they are a challenge to us as Aussies, particularly when you consider that the World Bank has said about Australians who are on the dole. Okay? Please see this in its context. If you're on the dole and you live in Australia, you're in the top 5% economically in the world. So when we talk about wealth, when we talk about privilege, when we talk about the kind of country in which we live, it's quite sobering when you see what begins to take place in Solomon's life, and I think it's been one of the great challenges for the Christian church in my lifetime, really. When I was born, 70% of Aussies went to church, and we've seen that steadily decline, haven't we? We've seen our values eroded. And we've seen the things that we can do, the things that we can make, our affluence and everything that's gone with it begin to take people away from the Lord and from the church. And I think that's mirrored in the life of Solomon. So as we look at these two chapters, I want to sort of read it a bit as a Bible study and then draw a number of lessons from it as we walk our way through. And I'd just like to read the story, comment as we go, and then seek to apply it to our lives. Let's pray, shall we? Father, as we come to your word, and as we look at the example of this man of wisdom, it's sobering to see some of the steps that were taken. And I pray that we would be open to hear from you and to learn from his example as we look at it together now. Speak to us and encourage us in our personal journey with you, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen. We begin to see Solomon take downward steps, and I find that pretty sobering and pretty tough to see and to watch, and it gets worse as these two passages progress. You'll see even more of it next week. The historian writing 1 Kings doesn't want us to miss it. He wants us to see it for what it is. And that's why it's there in black and white for us in our Bibles. And we see it happen in people's lives. You know, you see people begin to make excuses as to why they don't come to church. And then they might only come once a month. Then they might only come every couple of months. And eventually they stop coming. It generally is reflected initially in how, as my father used to say, how it hits their hip pocket. In other words, they start not to give as generously. Their heart begins to dry up. Their focus is more upon themselves. And a pastor friend of mine said at a seminar and made this statement. This is what he said for us. I'm just waiting for this to fire up. I think it's coming. It's not clicking on. There we go. Look for where a person's heart is and you'll see what that person's living for. That's a pretty powerful statement, isn't it? Look for where a person's heart is and you'll see what they're living for. Well, we're going to have a look at Solomon's heart now. So let's read from verse 1, 1 Kings 9. I have the NIV. I know that the NIV has been provided for you as well. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and had achieved all that he desired to do, not what God wanted, all that he desired to do. I think this is a repetitive phrase that comes out in the text. The Lord appeared to him a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, Solomon, I've heard the prayer and plea you've made before me. I have consecrated the temple which you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. As for you, if, Solomon, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and uprightness, as your father David did, and do all I command and decree and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever. As I promised David your father when I said, you shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I've given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated. Remember, this is God speaking. I'll reject this temple that I've consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword, an object of ridicule among all peoples. And though this temple is now imposing, all who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? What a question. And people will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, worshipping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them. At the end of 20 years, during which Solomon built these two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon, as a result of doing that, gave, and you would have looked a little bit at this last week or the weeks before, King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre, because Hiram had supplied him with all the cedar and pine and gold that Solomon wanted. But when Hiram went from Tyre to see the towns that Solomon had given him, he was not pleased with them. That's interesting, isn't it? Why wasn't he pleased with them? What kind of towns are these you have given me, my brother? He asked. And he called them the land of Kabul, a name they have to this day. Now, it's interesting. I think the Hebrews were a little bit like Aussies. You know how we have shortened names and we have slang terms? Well, the Hebrews use slang words as well. So it would be a word that sounded like a word in their language. And Kabul is one of those words. And you know what it sounds like? In Hebrew, it sounds like the word that means good for nothing. Solomon, these towns are good for nothing. Why do you insult me like this? Now remember, Solomon is the wealthiest man on the face of the earth at this point. And the best he can do for all that Hiram has done is give him some towns that are good for nothing. And he wasn't a very happy man. He wasn't a very happy man at all. But I think it begins to reveal something of what's going on inside Solomon. Now, Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. Do you know what a talent of gold was? Well, they used to have weights or measures, and a big rock would be taken, and that big rock would weigh about just under 50 kilo. That's one talent. Now, do your sums as to what that might be worth today when you're talking about 50 kilo of gold, all right? But he had given him 120 talents of gold, 120 times 50 kilos, a pretty big bit of gold, right? Reminds me of a scripture that we have in the New Testament where John says, for everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life comes not from the Father, but comes from the world. Now, you remember that God had said to the kings, and you've seen this already in your study, God has said to the kings, and he says to the kings repeatedly into the future, do not amass much gold. Don't have a lot of horses. Okay, getting the picture? Then God said, don't have many wives. Uh-oh, Solomon's really in strife. Somebody said, how did Solomon die? Do you know how Solomon died? One night he said, coming to bed, dear? And there were 700 and 300 all came at once and he died of suffocation. I don't know whether that's true or not. But the reality is he'd certainly broken God's rule at that point, hadn't he? I mean, it was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. You see, the lust of the eyes is something that you see and you want. The lust of the flesh is something you desire. And the pride of life is how people speak about you. It's your reputation and how you're seen in the eyes of other people in a prideful sense. And after 20 years, Hiram has been a friend to Solomon. He gives Solomon a heap of gold and Solomon gives him a group of towns that are called good for nothing. It's a miserly response. So let's continue because there's a bit of overlap in the language. Verse 15. Here is the account of the forced labour King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple. So he goes back to the temple and the palace. And his own palace, the supporting terraces, the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor, Megiddo and Giza. You see, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had attacked early in earlier years and destroyed Giza. He'd set it on fire. He'd killed its Canaanite inhabitants and gave it as a wedding gift to his daughter, Solomon's wife. And Solomon rebuilt Giza. He built up Lower Beth Horon, Baalath, Tadmor in the desert within his land, as well as all his store cities and the towns for his chariots, and towns built specifically for his horses. Unbelievable. Whatever he desired. Notice that? That's what it says of Solomon. Whatever he desired to build in Jerusalem or beyond in Lebanon and throughout all the territory, he ruled. He did it. Solomon's wealth is on display in a city of wealth. Never before, never since had Jerusalem prospered like it did under Solomon. A city for his horses. He withheld nothing. His eyes saw. That's what he said in Ecclesiastes. He withheld nothing that he desired or his eyes could see. All the people left from the Amorites, Hittites, this is verse 20, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, these people were not Israelites. That is, their descendants remaining in the land whom the Israelites could not exterminate. These Solomon conscripted for his slave labour as it was to the day that the chronicler, the historian, was writing. But Solomon did not make slaves of any of the Israelites. Oh, that was very good of him. Solomon conscripted these people and they were his fighting men, his government officials, his officers, his captains, the commanders of his chariots and his charioteers. They were also the chief officials in charge of Solomon's projects, 550 officials supervising the men who did the work. And after Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the place Solomon had built for her, he constructed the supporting terraces. Three times a year, Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings on the altar he had built for the Lord, burning incense before the Lord along with them, and so fulfilled the temple obligations. Hang on a minute. Was it Solomon's job to conduct the worship? Uh-uh. It was the priest's job. He even took that into his own hands. He even began to do those things, a bit similar to Saul not waiting for Samuel and going ahead of Samuel. And I want to suggest to you that there is worship here by Solomon, but it was empty worship. He was going through the motions. It's a little bit like going to church but not being in church. And it's possible, isn't it? It's possible to come to church and just go through the motions, but not really come to meet Jesus and to listen to the Spirit of God and to respond to the Spirit of God and what he is wanting to say to us. King Solomon also built ships at Ezion Geber, which is near Elath in Edom, on the shore of the Red Sea. Hiram sent his men, because they were sailors who knew the sea, and to serve in the fleet with Solomon's men, and they sailed to Ophir. Many people think Ophir was India. And brought back, get this, 420 talents of gold. That's 420 times 50 kilo of gold, enough to sink the fleet, I think. Gold like you wouldn't believe coming into Israel and coming to Jerusalem. The stuff is the focus. And the historian doesn't want us to miss that. He didn't need any more. God sees through all this. As he said through the prophet, stop tearing your garments, start tearing your heart. Break your hearts before the Lord. Be open to the Lord and do what the Lord wants you to do. David wasn't perfect, but his heart was right. And that's why we saw earlier that God said to Solomon, you've got to have a heart like your father. Solomon wrote the Proverbs, didn't he? And it's interesting, isn't it, that Solomon wrote the majority of the warning about wealth in the Bible. And they're contained in the wisdom literature. And yet Solomon gives to others what's not worth anything. Towns that don't amount to anything. That's the only indication of what we see him giving. Have a look at some of the Proverbs, all right? Have I been pressing that? I have, haven't I? There you go. Do not wear yourself out to get rich. Have the wisdom to show restraint. Do you see restraint in Solomon's lifestyle at this point? Whoever trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will thrive like a green leaf. I think Solomon's starting to believe the press and what people are saying about him. Look at Matthew 19 and the teaching of Jesus. Jesus said to his disciples, I tell you the truth, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it is easy for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not a literal needle. It's the smallest gate on the wall of Jerusalem. And a camel to get through it needed to be dragged through it because they couldn't walk through it themselves. So I want to remind you, what is our responsibility? Certainly being in the top 5% economically in the world, probably most of us, and I think myself, in the top 2% in the world. 7 billion people. It's sobering. What is our attitude towards our wealth, our riches, and how generous are we with it? Look at Jesus teaching in Mark 12. It's a wonderful passage. I didn't take the time to type it up yesterday. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in 2 very small copper coins, worth only a fraction of a penny. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others, the people who are making a great display of what they did. They gave out of their wealth, But she gave out of her poverty and put in everything, all she had to live on. And I share with you a statistic in Australia that I think is damning for the Christian church. Do you know the churches that are in the lowest socioeconomic areas in Australia give more per person than those churches that are in the wealthy suburbs? We have a little church in Carrawarra that Damo and Miriam were a part of for a time and had some involvement at Carrawarra. Miriam still does the books, actually. And that little church is in the second poorest community in Perth. The mother church that planted it don't give the same proportionately as the people in that congregation. And that's in the South Perth, city of South Perth. But the church in Carrawarra, second poorest community in Perth, give more per head than the church in the South Perth, city of South Perth. You want to know why? They're not as attached to their dollars. They're not as attached to their dollars. And that's right across the board. Some of the most generous people I've ever encountered have been in the slums of our world. Incredible. Sacrificial giving is what Jesus looks for. And I ask this question regularly of myself, but also of our congregations over the years. When was the last time we made a sacrificial gift to the Lord's work, where it actually cost us something? It's a solemn question. Well, the slide of Solomon continues. It doesn't get any better, and we need to move on. We're now into chapter 10. And when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with some hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, you can just imagine it, can't you? A queen with a caravan with all the goods and the splendour and stuff laid on, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold, precious stones. She came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. Can you imagine being Solomon when you know everything? I have to confess, when I was younger, some people called me a know-it-all, because I was always putting in my bob's worth. And I had to learn, particularly through Bible colleges, that God gave me two of these and one of these to use in that proportion. I had to learn to listen and engage with people. You know, when the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built and the food on his table and the seating of his officials and the splendour, the attending servants, even the servants were in robes, his cupbearers, the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed, so impressed. Do you see what's happening? She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom's true. But I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report I heard." Wow. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. And she gave the king another 120 talents of gold. 120 talents, 5,500 kilos of gold she gave him. Large quantities of spices, precious stones. Never again were so many spices brought in as those the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Hiram's ships brought gold from Ophir. From there they brought their great cargoes of almugwood and precious stones. By the way, almugwood is what made the lyre and made the harps. The king used the almug wood to make the supports for the temple of the Lord, for the royal palace, and to make harps and lyres for the musicians. So much almug wood has never been imported before or since. King Solomon gave Queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he had given her out of his royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her country. Now there's our verses. There's our picture. And I just think we see something beginning to happen in Solomon. So we were talking last night at the dinner table. I'm thankful that Solomon had the wisdom at the end of Ecclesiastes to say, remember the God of your youth. At least he was able to put something positive there towards the end. But when you look at his life of decadence and how he left it, when you look at the sad things that occurred from his sons onward, and a divided Israel, and an Israel ultimately that in chapter 9, the warning was there, they ended up being carried off into captivity, and the temple razed to the ground, and God's people a mockery. Can you imagine all this praise, what it did to Solomon? Solomon actually wrote these words. When we see what God was looking for, Solomon wrote, "The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but man is tested by the praise he receives." Man is tested by the praise he receives. How do you respond to praise? You see, the slide was gradual, and then it gained pace. Look at these words from James, James chapter 1. I just want to read them to you. "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is full grown, it gives birth to death." The slide from spiritual vitality and being alive is gradual, but it leads to destruction. And we need to take guard. The next two chapters you're going to talk about Solomon becoming cold to the things of God. And is it any wonder he falls? David repented. There's no clear indication of where Solomon ended up, but when you look at his family, it's a concern. David said, "I was the least in my family. When Samuel came looking for the next king of Israel, my dad didn't even think of me until Samuel said, 'Is there anyone else?' And then he thought of the little bloke out in the blocks." Or when you look at Paul, here's a true statement. Paul said, "I'm the chief of sinners. I'm the symbol of God's mercy. I wouldn't be anything apart from God and his love. Only follow my example as I follow the example of Jesus." So I'm going to close by just giving you some very simple points. It's going to take me 1 minute. Lessons from Solomon. Be a generous giver. As Paul said to the Thessalonians, they excelled in the grace of giving. May God say of the Margaret River Baptist Church, they're a generous church because they excel in the grace of giving and they bless God's work. Recognize our wealth and what we are doing with it. That's the question. And remember, God's looking for sacrificial giving. He's looking for giving that comes from the heart. God is looking for true heart worshippers, isn't he? People who worship him in spirit and in truth and in freedom, as we sang about this morning. And we are tested by our praise and how we respond to our praise. Make sure you give glory to the Lord, to God. Don't receive that for yourself. And the slide away from God is slow and ultimately leads to spiritual death. Learn from Solomon. Learn from those in his kingdom. And I want to leave you with this challenge, which for me is something that I hold very dearly. It's not how we begin our race or how we start our race. It's how we hit the finish line. It's how we hit the tape when God calls us home. I was privileged with Julie to say goodbye to her mum on Friday, and we had her funeral service. Mum was 103 years of age. You get 200 people come to her funeral, and the testimonies could have gone on for hours, because in 1959 she gave a life to Jesus and her life was completely turned around. And from that point on, for the next 60, 70 years, she just honoured God with her life and cast a net right across our state. When Mum went home a couple of weeks ago, God said, "Welcome home, you good and faithful servant. You've run your race well. You've finished well." So it's not how you start, it's how you finish.